Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 111, the first episode of season 6. This is American Bridge. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Sofarik, and we are very happy to have with us today in the studio Gregory Dreiser, who is a public historian. That is a person who works extensively in museums, designing exhibitions, and doing various scholarly work around, well, history, construction, architecture, urbanism, all kinds of things. His experience extends to the Museum of Vancouver, the Chicago Architecture Foundation, the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and a fellowship, I believe, at the City of New York Public Library. I'd like to welcome Gregory Dreiser. He is the author of American Bridge.
Hi there.
Well, this is a really exciting book, which is, I think it upends a lot of assumptions that we didn't really know that we had about the history of engineering, specifically bridge engineering. And I think I want to start with a question of why today do we know what a how truss is, or at least those of us who are in the engineering world, but we rarely hear the name of Ithiel Town mentioned. Who was Ithiel Town, and why is he the protagonist of American Bridge?
Okay, well, Ithiel Town is known to architectural historians, but beyond them, he's not really known. And that actually, why he's not known is a question that interested me. I mean, he is basically a founder of the architectural and engineering profession the way it is enacted or the way it's practiced today, meaning it's about selling intellectual property and overseeing projects rather than actually building. And Town, I mean, it's a very unusual story. Town was very prominent as an architect. He's considered one of the founders of Greek Revival with his partner, A.J. Davis. He also patented a bridge that was known as a lattice bridge. And that's kind of the core or the launch point of the story that I'm telling, because that became one of the bridges known around the world as a quote-unquote American bridge. Ironically, Town was actually what I call an America maker, someone deliberately developing an image of what America should be or what Americans should be like through his architecture. However, the ironic thing is his bridge actually gave to the whole world an idea of what it meant to be American. And I'm putting air quotes in, people can't see it, because for me, a big question in this book, and especially in these days when nationalism is just rising, like, what does it mean when we actually say, you know, something is American or something is French? But sorry, to get back to your question, you know, Town was part of the elite very much. He like was friends with Morse and Cooper, the writer Cooper, Last of the Mohicans. But at the same time, and he's just been forgotten, or you could even today we'd say he's been canceled. But that's maybe another question we say. But he was just a super prominent designer. And exploring him and how he did what he did is one piece of the book, American Bridge.
Yeah, so he's best known for pioneering this lattice-type bridge, which is quite interesting as it was really considered an American product and American export. There's two dimensions to that your book explores and that I would want to explore here. One is that it was predominantly thought of as being limited to wood construction or having its origins in wood construction. And indeed, today, I cannot think of a single lattice bridge in the United States that isn't wood and inside of a covered bridge. Whereas in Europe, you tend to see a lot of iron lattice bridges, especially on railways from the Victorian era and forward or thereabouts. Why is that, and how does this idea of the material being used coincide with the described nationality of these methods of engineering?
Okay. Yeah, that is a great and beautiful question, because one thing that I discovered in doing this work is that how people look at materials, the stories they share about those materials, in a big way actually creates those materials. And I'll explain what I mean. First of all, one of the questions that I ask, and I ask very simple questions, and that's what actually helps me challenge the big predominant stories out there. And so I asked, like, what's a wooden bridge? Because you always hear, everywhere you read about bridges or structures, they always talk about the first iron bridge, the first iron that. They never really tell you why. You're just supposed to assume, oh, like iron is superior to wood, for example, or it's has some quality that makes it better. But one of the things that I discovered that so surprised me was that so-called wooden bridges from the very earliest times were actually using metal, iron, and sometimes tons, and I mean literally tons of metal as connectors, right? So, and this is from the early, if you look at the earliest books that show bridges, like around the 1720s, there's a well-known book, you can see they're using iron. So why are these being labeled wooden? A lot of the history of technology that we read, and actually it goes way beyond history of technology, is based on an idea of evolution, right? And it's very closely allied to actually progress, but that things, one thing is tied to the next and they're all related and it's getting better and better and better. Okay, so in many ways that, I mean, you could call that a myth. I mean, in academia, you know, progress most people don't believe in it, but the general public, I think, still does. And in all popular depictions you read about, people write books that say technology evolves. That's a fairy tale, honestly. Biologists say that you know, invention and evolution, they're not related in the way that it's put forth. But what I want to say is this. So there's this idea about evolution, and very strongly in the 19th century, there was an idea of, there was a hierarchy from savage to barbarian to civilized man. And of course, guess what? The civilized man was the white European. And so what happens is these materials get linked to the hierarchy. So in other words, it seems like, well, the unsophisticated or uncivilized people used wood, and now we're using iron and steel. And so, like, we've progressed beyond. But, of course, wood and iron are different materials, and we can use them in all kinds of different ways. Both of them are flammable. You know, one rusts, one rots. I mean, they have all kinds of... But there's this idea that metal is superior. And so I'll mention one more thing about this, is that... So every history that you'll read of industrialization, or you read about skyscrapers, wood basically doesn't enter into it. There are books written about construction where wood actually doesn't play any role, okay? But one of the things that I discovered that just blew my mind was Ithiel Town, who patented this structure, he deliberately made it all out of wood because at that time, metal was expensive. It wasn't always reliable, you know, reliably manufactured, and it rusted. So actually creating something completely out of wood was amazing. And not only that, he did it out of what we now would call uniform parts. It was a modular structures. It was just planks and just pegs. And I don't want to go into too much detail here, but previously, if you had a wooden structure, you would have what's called a mortise and tenon joint. Very complex. Every joint is handmade. To be able to create a long span structure or beam using just planks and just pegs is something builders wanted to do for decades and decades. And it was mind-boggling. It actually took me a long time to understand that itself. Like, this is one of the reasons that people all over the globe were blown away by it. Now, so in a way, it's just set a standard. And so you can read all about industrialization, you know, the great rise of industry and progress. And there's this thing about, you know, stone to wood to metal. But that is... You know, that's a story that it's time to challenge in a big way, because wood is not inferior to metal. It's a different material. And the way we look at those materials actually ties in a lot to our values and the stories that we're hearing. And so, again, asking simple questions like what is a wooden bridge can actually lead you into challenging some of these big stories that you hear all the time.
All right, I will leave the wood to Dan because that's really his category there, with wood and construction. And yeah, there is something that struck me when we were scheduling this. Like, you know, if you can condense this episode, perhaps it would be that meme there, the notion of like, you know, we don't even know how to build this now, like this idea of these sort of lost techniques. But before we move on, Greg, I want to ask, you know, yeah, to your point there, I mean, progress, of course, is a political concept, and, you know, in the grand scheme of things, going back to the Enlightenment, and evolution is a process there too. But there is sort of a thing received, this idea, you know, of the adjacent possible, from like the W. Brian Arthurs of the world and Stuart Kaufman's, that innovation and technological invention happens where each creation opens up branching possible pathways to lead to the next step. And that's my question, is like, do you think that story is completely wrong? Or is it, you know, or because there's also the flip side of what you're describing too, is like now there's a whole lot of interest in like Julia Watson, her low tech, the idea of like, well, let's go back and rediscover lost indigenous knowledge, that, you know, that basically the Enlightenment passed over all of this incredible tacit knowledge that the indigenous peoples did because of exactly the kind of hierarchies there. I'm curious, like, what do you think is the larger lessons about how innovation and invention happens, particularly when it comes to the use of materials and technology?
Okay, cool. Okay, so I would say that I'm not rejecting that view at all. I think invention is definitely a networked, collaborative activity. And in fact, you know, I think many people actually still believe kind of in the great man, great hero inventor, right? I mean, that has been more or less debunked again and again, but it's just somehow easy to believe in this, in this kind of fairy tale. However, it's totally correct that in, you know, any kind of inventive or creative activity, whether it's you call it technological or you call it cultural, or you're talking about cooking, it doesn't matter what, is always coming about through many different people working on a problem, or, you know, a question, a problem, a challenge. And so one thing that's interesting about that is we often hear about American technology or American innovation. So an interesting thing is, like, America can levy taxes or put on, you know, or, you know, draft people into the army, but America does not invent. No nation invents. And why that's important is when you go back and look at invention, it was part of the book American Bridges, where I really looked at who did what and how. You have people in different parts of the world facing similar questions, and these people are in touch. And you didn't need an internet, you didn't need telephone, you didn't even need telegraph. You had people traveling and visiting and talking, you had them writing. And then when, you know, the rise of publishing and book printing really helped that. And so you had people in different places communicating. And so it's, you know, it's not really about progress. You know, whether you think things are getting better or you think they're getting worse, that's a judgment that any one of us can make about anything. But what's definitely happening is people are communicating with each other all over, and we like to pretend, oh, there's this, you know, this nationalist joy that comes about by saying, you know, this is French, this is American, or this is British, for example. But that's, again, that's a story that, in a way, in terms of invention, is easily debunked. And one thing you also asked about, for example, indigenous knowledge and different types of knowledge, and this is, again, like a whole other big question, but knowledge is often classified or labeled in certain ways. I mean, for example, even science and technology, that's labeling knowledge in a way that often doesn't really describe what's going on. You know, what I'll say in reality, if you still believe in reality, because people are using all kinds of knowledge. And after something's invented, for example, then suddenly, you know, the academic engineers will say, oh, it's because of the rise of science, right? But often that is a, you know, a big tale which needs to be examined, because often technologists are doing things and they have all kinds of knowledge. And from their practical knowledge and from their reading, they know all kinds of things. And who cares if it's labeled science or technology, which actually many people think is kind of an anachronistic classification. We shouldn't even use that. But so, you know, whether indigenous, it wouldn't surprise me at all, actually. And there are cases of it where people in North America, you know, the colonists were using indigenous knowledge. I'm pretty sure that's what was going on. And so the knowledge comes from all over. It's only afterwards that we place this story on it. We nationalize it. We say it's a certain kind of knowledge. And that, you know, what's important about that is it changes the past. The stories we tell change our past and also change our future. I think that's what's really big about it, because if we think of things work in a certain way, if we think, you know, nations are in competition with each other, that's going to really shape how we, you know, it's going to shape policy. It's going to shape how people work.
Indeed. I mean, the book's called American Bridge, and you would think that from that title, and you didn't know anything about the rest of your thesis, it would be that, well, this is, if anything, going to be about American bluster and about us crowing about how awesome we are. And maybe that's, you know, the immediacy of our current moment that might make us retroactively reflect back on our history that way. But, you know, we're a prideful nation. We like to toot our own horn. But actually, the designation American Bridge was bestowed by Europeans, especially the British, and not necessarily flatteringly. I mean, there's a lot of professional jealousy doesn't even really quite cover it. It seems like a lot of this was motivated by a combination of professional jealousy and vested interests, industrial interests, you know, people who wanted to sell and produce iron, as well as political interests, people who wanted to advance the cause of Rule Britannia. And I say Britannia with purpose here, because the Britannia Bridge stands as almost the kind of, not exactly the villain, but the sort of counter story to the Lattice Bridge. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the Britannia Bridge, what happened to it, who was behind it, and why some of the language that comes out of particularly Britain, but also other places in Europe, in discussing the American Bridge, kind of sounds like a bunch of drag queens, you know, like slapping each other up. I mean, like, these guys were bitchy.
Yeah. Okay. So before I get to the Britannia Bridge, I just want to say about the title. Like, I call, you know, it's in a way, it's called American Bridge, but it's really questioning what an American bridge is. And, you know, that title, which you're right, in Britain, it seems in particular, there was a lot of kind of anti-American sentiment. You know, I think it's because of the a lot of competition. And in France and in Germany and elsewhere, I think that it was maybe more embracing. And the idea of American at that time was tied into, you know, what we now call techno-utopianism, that this kind of new technology, just like people talk about the internet and still do, maybe, I don't know if they do, that this technology is going to bring the world together. And it's going to, you know, help everyone. And so the labeling carries with it all kinds of meanings, which we need to understand. But what it doesn't do is actually say, you know, how the invention actually took place. In terms of the Britannia story is complex. It was a bridge. People who know about engineering know the Britannia Bridge. It was built in England in the mid 19th century, and we've been reading, every book you read will talk about it. But almost none of those books would mention, for example, the Lattice Bridge, because that bridge, which was a tube of iron, it was a symbol. And first of all, the metal was kind of stood for a symbol of Imperial Britain and the strength, you know, the eternal strength of the empire. So there was that part of it. And then Britain had a really powerful iron manufacturing industry, and so they were promoting it. And in fact, Stevenson, who was the engineer responsible for the bridge, you know, wrote about the bridge itself. He even wrote an article, someone ghost wrote for him an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which basically said, like, this is the beginning of iron building. But what I look at is that, in fact, Stevenson and a lot of other people knew about lattice bridges at the time. It certainly was a model for him. But that's something you will never, I mean, you'll just never read it anywhere. Even though when you go back and look, and there's a lot of stuff published about it because it was a well-known bridge, you can see how important the lattice was. And what's actually kind of amusing to me is that at the time, this tubular bridge, which you'll read about again, like in every book, history of bridges, was actually a failure as a bridge type. From the very beginning, people were saying,
This is incredibly heavy, unbelievably expensive. Who would build like this? We need to build with lattice-type bridges. And so, again, that's a history which I would say has been like hidden almost or concealed. And the reason it's concealed is we keep hearing over and over about the Industrial Revolution and industrialization and how metal was, you know, iron and steel, that's what it was all about. And that Britain, you know, is the, I don't know what to say, the highest, is like the climax. It's the place where the Industrial Revolution happened. And, you know, and Americans were copiers, you know, or stealers of ideas. And so I just, you know, I'm hoping my book helps just debunk all that. And that, and that, you know, we can really think about and basically just do the research and try to understand what really happened. Because one thing I'll also add is, I don't know if this is maybe stronger in the history of engineering and design, but if Stevenson or whatever designer writes about their own work, that's great. That's super important information. But for historians later to take that uncritically, I mean, you can see there are a lot of issues there. I mean, would we take, you know, if any president was to write their own story, would we just take that and repeat it without thinking about it? So anyway, yeah.
All right, so great. That's the perfect segue here. You'll forgive me if I do a tangent here, but this is, yeah, the generalizable lessons of a technological revolution, a massive investment boom, a lot of national self-aggrandizement. It has a lot of parallels with the present and a different technology than railways, per se. But I think about the fact that, you know, we're taping this as Davos is ending, and there's apparently a lot of discussion, as always, about, you know, the AI bubble in Davos. And a reminder that Jeff Bezos, I think it was several months ago, at least it was in 2025, said that, no, it's a bubble, but it's a good bubble. And by good bubble, he compared it to the 1840s railway boom, where it will produce a lot of productive infrastructure when that bubble eventually bursts. And I'm curious, Greg, what are the generalizable parallels between the 1840s railway boom and there, and British industrialization and their national project of doing this? Because now the United States is involved in, like, you know, today we would be writing about American AI, which was also a year ago right now took a big hit to its ego and stock valuations by the release of Chinese models as well too. So these narratives, it's all that there's a real echo into the future here, which, you know, I'm not sure how much you want to engage in, but yeah. I can't help but think of it, to say the least.
I think there are, you know, many parallels. I'm not an expert in railway building, but I think there were, you know, a lot of parallels. I mean, first of all, you can compare AI or the internet. Those are all about communication and in some cases transportation. And they're allowing the flow of, in some cases, people, but certainly ideas and people to connect with each other. And so railways, right, the building of the railways, when you see the numbers, which I don't have on the top of my head, but within a few decades, the amount of railway that was built is mind-boggling, even today, mind-boggling, and especially today when we can't even build, in the U.S., can't even build, you know, a relatively short high-speed rail. When you see what was built then, it's mind-boggling. But the thing is, I think there was also, and this is where I'm a little shaky, but there was a lot of overbuilding. And you know, a lot of railway companies went bust. There were a lot of railways built that actually were unsafe and were poorly designed, and I think people might think it's a new thing today, like build quickly, build cheap, and then iterate. Well, that's not new, because actually that is how railways, for example, in the U.S. were built, also deliberately. So there are many parallels, and there were many hopes and, you know, utopian ideals attached to things. But again, there are all kinds of things that we may not know. For example, I think many people in the U.S. may not know that enslaved people were incredibly important in the building of railways. In Britain and the Northeast U.S. and the South, those were the places that had the most railways at one time. And in the South in particular, those railways were not only built by enslaved people under conditions, horrific conditions, they actually also ran the railways. I mean, so there's also a, you know, it's hardly any news that slavery, in a way, is a foundation for industrial capitalism in the U.S. and actually all over the world. But when you actually know, like, how, you know, who built these things? You know, how did they expand? Who benefited? And actually, who's really benefiting and who's not? Of course, with AIs, you know, a massive question on many levels. And in a way, you could look at a lot of industrialization that way, and I think it's a good way to look at it.
Well, yeah, it's true. It's both the great man story and the great nation story often leaves out the people who are really doing the hard work. And in some cases, not just doing hard physical work, but innovating while they did that work, you know, completely swept under the carpet. That's a really interesting aspect of the book. I mean, of course, everyone knows that the South was built on slave labor, but if you think about that type of labor in American history, you think of the Chinese who were brought to build the Western railroads and the conditions that they suffered under. And it is strange that that part of the Southern dependency on the enterprise of slavery, the railroads aren't really discussed. And bridge building and civil engineering, everyone just thinks of plantation work and hard, you know, agricultural labor. So even that is a sort of unexpected piece of this story that when you first encounter it, you think, well, this is just going to be about, you know, cases of, zany inventors trying to outdo each other. But it's much more than that.
Yes. I mean, I try to take a kind of bigger picture look, you know, what's called interdisciplinary look at, you know, how invention takes place and what industrialization, what does that really mean? Why are we calling it that? And, you know, as I think I said, I just like to ask simple questions about, you know, big things and see where it takes me.
So if you had to go back, do you think you would have been in the pro-Lattice or anti-Lattice camp? Or are you... Are you more of a Warren Truss guy? Or are you a tube guy?
I definitely would have been a pro-Lattice because, you know, after looking at it and studying it and trying to understand it after all these years, I mean, this is what I would say about the Lattice as a structure, first of all, is that, as I said, it enabled the building of long spans, you know, unsupported long spans. And that was massive because... Again, you hear all the time, oh, the U.S. had so many forests, so much wood. But in fact, those forests were slaughtered. And from a very, very early period, people were already saying, we can't get long logs. And so that's actually why in the U.S., where supposedly there was a lot of wood, a system was built that actually used small pieces of wood. So the use of the small members... uniform small members, which could be rapidly constructed. And that's another, for me, that's actually the heart of it, because you could invent some great, interesting structure if it can't be built quickly, easily, and cheaply. And actually, in this case, what's called de-skilling, in other words, it required a lot less knowledge to build these bridges, even though it still required specialized knowledge. So I want to, you know, affirm that, but it required a lot less, so it enabled the rapid building of many structures quickly. And so I look at it in my book as actually an invention of the beam, which may sound crazy to people. What? A beam? You know, a beam has always existed. But in fact, a bridge is made of two parallel beams, and then you create a floor, let's say a floor and a roof structure, which also serves as bracing. But it actually gave people the ability to build long spans. And that was not just bridges. We're talking about buildings. Ithieltown himself used a lattice beam very early on. So it's not just around, bridges. So, sorry, I'm going to go on and on about lattices. I will say another thing about them, which is interesting, which we can't go into detail, but I go into detail in the book, which is that they were also very safe structures. They were safe because they had what we now call redundancy, meaning there are many parts and you can't even always analyze how the structure's working. There's a historian, Tom Peters, who says, like the grid system in Manhattan, when there's a traffic tie-up in one intersection, the cars can go around it and go into other places, even if it slows things down, It's still working. And that's actually a good analogy for the lattice bridge. There's, you know, if one part fails, it's still gonna stand up. And so at one point in the 19th century, there was a big debate about which bridges were safe, because they were actually building bridges that really had no redundancy. One part could fail and the bridge could collapse. And actually, this is still a very important issue, because it was not that long ago in Baltimore, where a boat took out a column, and removing that one column caused the whole bridge to collapse. Now, it's been known, I mean, I would say forever, that piers are vulnerable to shipping and to ice and to water. So to build a bridge that could collapse when one pier is removed is really something to think about. You know, it's a design question. It's a safety question. It's an investment question. It's an infrastructure question. You know, it reminds me that in the 19th century, there's an engineer who once said, like, an entire railway, the strength of an entire railway could depend on like one bolt in a bridge, because if that bridge collapses, the whole system goes down. And so, yeah, there are different levels of kind of network. I don't know if it's called network theory, but how networks work is really part of the lattice itself as a bridge, but also how the lattice functions within the bigger transportation infrastructure.
So do you think is the case that we don't see the lattice bridge very much anymore in the U.S. is because we moved fast and broke things, or because it wasn't because they were especially flammable or that they all burned? Because that would be the assumption you would make, knowing only that they were predominantly timber. But that wasn't the case, right?
So, yeah, a few things. First of all, the initial, people have also an idea even today that when something is invented or patented, that's what it is. But in fact, it's always being improved and changed. And so the initial lattice actually had issues. For example, it wasn't always, it sagged sometimes under heavy loads for a variety of reasons. So one thing that's great, and, you know, I kind of look at the lattice, I call it kind of an open source code, because it provided kind of a way of thinking, and it provided parts that others could take up. So you mentioned, for example, the Howe Bridge. There were other kinds of bridges where, and this is what I look at in the book, they all knew the lattice, and they all said either, you know, we can improve it or change it, or we can create something else kind of using this idea. And so they created other types of bridge, you know, structures and bridges. And then with the railways, you know, the weight and the power of the trains, for example, made a lot of the earlier bridges not really, you know, viable after a while. And I just want to say that iron bridges also don't necessarily have a longer life than a wooden bridge, I want to say. But so they, and there were railways, even, you know, in Maine in the late 19th century, maybe early 20th, they actually were still using lattice bridges for railways. And this is an interesting thing. So there are always choices. You know, you don't have to, you know, you can use wood, you can use metal. You got to look at your conditions in the one, you know, wherever you're building. What are the conditions? What do we need? What's really viable? You know, what's the long-term cost, short-term cost? So that, I mean, so eventually, you know, there were many types of bridges, many choices, and people, you know, they use them. And iron, for a lot of reasons, would be chosen for railway systems today, even though there are all kinds of options. So there are still lattice bridges around, and actually there are many covered bridge festivals around, and people love old covered bridges. But one thing they don't know yet, but I'm hoping they'll know soon, is that these covered bridges were like high-tech icons. And it's not an exaggeration to say they enabled the transformation of the design world. So, you know, I hope I'm going to reach out to some of the covered bridge people and, you know, talk to them and see if we can organize something to get the word out.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing where your next direction goes, because the way that you treat this subject is, I think, a really interesting perspective. Is not not really an engineer's perspective. It's a historian's perspective, which brings it degrees of humanity, I think, and intersection with you know, geopolitics and industrial history that are not intuitive. And so I think you've really accomplished something here with American Bridge.
Thanks very much. And I should add, you're right, I'm not an engineer, and that's actually unusual for this kind of book, but I've learned a lot along the way, and I've consulted, you know, many engineers to be sure that I really understand things. But in a way, it's to my advantage, because so much of engineering history has been written by engineers. And so it's also embedded with a certain, you could say, professional bias. So I'm hoping, you know, we can readjust that. And I think engineers, as well as anyone, can appreciate kind of what we can learn about engineering, about design, about invention, yeah, about why we call things American.
Worth questioning. Greg Dreiser, thank you very much. This has been another episode of Unfrozen. Greg Dreiser is the author of American Bridge.
Thank you.